For about a quarter of a century now, I've been in search of the story of the Underground Railroad. I'm Tony Cohen, historian and explorer of the American past. The pursuit of history is a process, and the process never ends. You're listening to Rooted Wisdom. In recent years, we've been watching more of Harriet Tubman's story come to light. One of those overlooked chapters involves her father, Ben Ross, and the location of a cabin that he lived in, where we believe she would have spent time. I sat down with the chief archaeologist for the Maryland Department of Transportation to examine pieces of Harriet's story that she and her team have unearthed.
My name is Julie Shablitsky, and I'm the chief archaeologist and director of the Office of Cultural Resources for the Maryland Department of Transportation.
That's a mouthful.
Yes. I'm trying to remember what I do.
What is it you do?
Well, I am there in the Hanover area at MDOT, and what I do there is I direct and oversee archaeological projects that right now are focusing on everything Harriet Tubman.
That's great. Most notably, you've been working on a site that has become known as Ben's 10.
Yeah, Ben's 10 is the home place of Harriet Tubman's father, Ben Ross. Mm-hmm. And people have called it that because when his enslaver, Anthony Thompson, passed away, in his will of 1836, it specifically states that Ben Ross is going to be allowed to live upon 10 acres of land, use the timber on the Thompson property, and within 5 years, half his freedom. So people have just called his place Ben's 10 for short.
And when did you become aware of this acreage, and how did you come to start working there?
It was interesting, right before COVID hit. So what is that, 2020, I think?
2020.
Yeah, so February 2020, I received a phone call from the Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge manager, Marcia Pradines, and she said, "Julie, we need help finding Ben's 10." And I said, "What is Ben's 10?" And she explained that it was Ben Ross's home place, and that Kate Larson...
So that's Kate Clifford Larson, historian and Harriet Tubman biographer who wrote Bound for the Promised Land.
Believes she knows about where the place may be located. It should be on this new property we're acquiring. And I said, okay, well, let's go ahead and do a quick trip out there. Well, at that time, a month later, everything shut down. So then in September, when things began to open back up, we went out there with our masks on and began to look at the location of where it could possibly be. And Anthony Thompson, he owned about 1,000 acres at the time. So this was just a small portion of that property. And when I began to look along Harrisville Road, this old historic road where Kate believed that somewhere out here it was located, I thought, oh yeah, you know, I told them out loud. I said, yeah, we can find it. But in the back of my mind, I was thinking, there's no way we're gonna find exactly where Ben Ross lived. I mean, how can we? I mean, it's inundated, it's wooded, it has, you know, recent places where it's been logged and forested. There's no way we're gonna be able to find this place. But I also am an eternal optimist, so I thought it's worth a try. I also was kind of afraid because I thought that it'd be hard to determine where exactly his cabin would have been from others, because people were living out there for, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years if you look at Native people.
Yes.
And how do we decide which one is Ben's place? So that was difficult.
And how did you seal the deal? How did you find the location?
Found the place with good old-fashioned archaeology, and luckily only one place from the first half of the 19th century, the 1800s, was in that search area. So we began with looking at the historical documents. We looked at old maps. We looked at descriptions about the mention of Old Ben's place is in this direction. Old Ben's place is down below the Parker Fields, which was the person who bought the property after Thompson passed. And so we had a search area at least, right? And so within that search area, within that circle, we began to dig shovel test pits. And shovel test pits are these round foot and a half diameter holes. And we dig them down till we get to what we call subsoil, which is no longer are we finding artifacts or historic soil. So we went out there, and along and around this road, we dug hole after hole after hole. And we were into the almost 700, 800 holes dug in this property. And I'm thinking, where is it? There's nothing here. And then I said, well, I'm going to go ahead and grab my metal detector. So I grabbed my metal detector and I thought, well, if I'm looking for an old building, a cabin, I'm going to have to use this technology to try and find bits of nails and hardware. Yeah, that look like a house. So I went out there and I began swinging the metal detector, you know, across the swampy land. Mm. And almost with first 2 to 3 minutes out there, I got this beep, beep, beep. And it was a really good signal. Metal detectorists can determine whether you have ferrous iron, which would be a nail, but they can also determine whether they have brass or lead, which is exciting because it could be buttons or old historic shot. It was a good sound. So I got my archaeologist technician out there with me and we dug the hole up and he reached into the hole and pulled it up. And I'm like, this has to be something modern. It's probably an old shell casing because it was a hunting area. So I didn't get too excited. But then when he showed it to me and it was circular and round, and I said, is this a coin? And it was larger than the modern day coins. So we rubbed it, we looked at it, and it was from the year 1808. And it was a Liberty head.
Wow. So at that point, what happens? Does a gang of archaeologists descend on the site and soil is flying and things are being laid? Like, paint the picture.
At this point, it wasn't where X marks a spot. It wasn't the site of Ben Ross's home. But what it was, I looked at it as an omen because 1808 is a significant year. It's the year that the United States outlawed the transatlantic slave trade. It's also the year that Ben Ross and Rick Green, Harriet Tubman's mother, married and began a family. So with those two dates, I'm like, this is a sign. We need to keep on digging. So we kept on digging and we dug around that location, but there was nothing. That was an isolated find. There was nothing else around it, not anything. So we just kind of abandoned that search area and kept on moving along on our path towards the water. And began digging and digging, and we were up to around 1,000 holes, and eventually we began to get little crumbs of artifacts from the 19th century. And that was the end of the project, and we had to stop that November of 2020 with just 5 or 6 little artifacts in our hand that said, come back. And that's what we did. We came back the following season. We opened up larger excavation units, which are 5-foot by 5-foot holes, and began to dig on a checkerboard-like pattern and found everything we needed to find for a 19th century house site, which were nails, window glass, broken ceramics, teacups, buttons, bricks, all those things that said someone lived here during the first half of the 19th century, and they were probably impoverished and didn't have a lot of belongings. And then since that time, we've been digging almost every year since.
You find this footprint, you're starting to collect the material evidence. What leads you to think that it's an African-American site or a home that was lived by an impoverished family?
Those are good questions. So I also get the question, how do you know Ben Ross lived there? And so, of course, I don't have a picture of Ben Ross walking there and his family being there or anything like that. But so what we have to do is we have to basically take the puzzle pieces, put them together, and say that we probably haven't. And the reason I think that is because within that entire search area, the only place that we found that dates from that time period that could be linked to someone that's on record is Ben Ross. Mm. I thought that I'd have the problem where I'd have lots of different 19th century sites, but that wasn't it at all. This was the only contender. So it didn't have to compete with any other historic sites from that time period. But then when you started looking at the archaeology, I was also interested in like where exactly is the footprint of the home, because we in a sense just had a scattering over the years. This area has incurred a lot of impacts from logging, from hunting, from heavy equipment driving on top of it. So a lot of what we have, the soils themselves are compressed down and the artifacts within that soil have been broken down and spread around. That makes it kind of difficult for archaeologists. So even though we have this like scattering of historic material from that first half of the 19th century, and we can tell you we have a home there, I can't tell you where the exact corners of that house were. Mm. Now, usually if you have a cabin or a place that's not really supposed to stand for that long, you'll have these brick piers on the corners. And sometimes you can find those if the preservation is there. Sometimes if you go back, especially to the 18th century or even very, very early 19th century, you'll be able to find these earth-fast homes or these kind of post and ground structures. So what that means is we were looking for either one of those, but if the building itself was sitting on brick piers, those brick piers are gone. We do have holes in the ground, but none of them match up exactly like we want. That might be just the situation where if it's a post and ground structure, we just haven't dug enough, or the stains are gone. But we do believe we do have a home. I just can't tell you how big it was. But I can tell you that someone was impoverished there because of the artifact collections. That means the ceramics, the types of ceramics they had, the teacups, the bowls, the pitchers. All of those artifacts are someone that didn't have a lot of money. You're not, and it's not only what you find, it's what you don't find. I'm not finding toys. I'm not finding porcelain pieces, high-end glassware. So nothing's telling me someone of any means really lived here. We also look at animal bones.
Yes.
What were they eating? So we know enslaved people were given rations, perhaps fish, pork, pork fat, things that don't always survive in the archaeological record. But sometimes, well, most of the times really, they had to go out and supplement their diet by hunting and capturing different animals. So we would expect things like turtles, raccoons, clams, oysters, fish, anything that could be quickly grabbed.
Did you find that?
Yes, we found that the family there, Ben Ross, was eating a lot of pork. There's a lot of pork represented there. We had oysters, turtle, and those were the most fossil material that we found. So he was being fed, but it wasn't enough. So that's why we're finding evidence of their gathering.
I find it interesting. You had mentioned the coin from 1808, which has the significance of tying to the end of the importation of Africans to the United States, and then also kind of paralleling first decade of the 19th century, the Louisiana Purchase, and then the phenomenon of the domestic slave trade from the Chesapeake to the Deep South as those fertile Gulf Coast states and territories are coming into play. And it kind of formed a second Middle Passage. And so many people were being siphoned from the Eastern Shore to the slave markets of Savannah and Mobile and New Orleans, of course, is the biggest one. And that is a story that follows Harriet Tubman's family, sisters of hers who were sold off. And you also mentioned that's about the time that Ben Ross and Rit Green were married. Ben is enslaved by Anthony Thompson and Rit by the Pattison family. So you have two households which are joined. What would it have been like, pre-dig, of what that setting would have been like, and especially for a newly established enslaved family?
So coming to Dorchester County right off the ship and coming in that area, it would have been hard. I believe that the insect population, the mosquitoes, the biting flies, have probably increased, especially with climate change and sea level rise. So the things that we're seeing today weren't there when Ben Ross and Harriet Tubman were walking the earth. You wouldn't see the Phragmites. You wouldn't see the Sitka deer that are there today. Those are all invasive or brought here by others. And you wouldn't see this increase in water. So when we were digging at Ben Ross's place, we would dig a hole and go for lunch and turn around and our holes would be filled up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so climate change and sea level rise is real and it's threatening that place. So historically, I think that things looked a little bit different, but it still would have been rough. It's a wetland, it's hot a lot of times in the summer, and it can be very, very cold. So they're coming to a place that has fluctuating extremes in temperature and heat, and then they're basically being given a starvation diet to survive upon and do brutal, hard, excruciating work. And it was a wicked system.
And I guess some of that excruciating or similar fashion is transferred to the archaeological process, being out there in the same or similar environment, definitely same location, you're facing some of those same elements in trying to recover this. Can you describe who your team was and how you actually did the work there every day?
most of them consultants to MDOT. So we would hire different people. So the people digging in the holes might change from season to season. And we had some other archaeologists that are with us more long term, and they were there helping direct. But we also brought Douglas Mitchell, who's a descendant of the Ross and Tubmans. He would come and actually dig in the dirt with us and experience it. And I remember asking him, you know, what is this like for you as someone who's descended from this sort of history? And he said, I feel both gratitude and humility. Because, you know, as a descendant, you can just imagine that their suffering and their survival gave them their life. And they're here today because of it. And as an archaeologist, it makes our work more important. It tells us and reminds us our work as archaeologists is not about the past or just only about the people who lived that during that time period. It's about living communities. It's about descendants. It's about being more of a liaison to them and trying to connect them with their heritage in a way that's, you know, we have to be selfless and remind ourselves. And also being a white archaeologist working with traumatic Black history is also a challenge. I know where my place is, and I know, and I am reminded that this is their heritage, this is their family. I find being a public servant, someone who works for MDOT, I'm also get a lot out of it by watching them have those visceral and emotional reactions to holding a button that their family may have worn on their clothing, you know, holding a broken teacup that their ancestor may have broken. Mm-hmm. So all those, I feel selfish myself just as a scientist, you know, being part of that. So it's a powerful emotional experience. It's not the dry archaeology and science that I thought it would be. It's very much anthropological.
That's incredible. How many artifacts, roughly, do you have a number for what was recovered?
Oh, we have hundreds of artifacts, but they're very small. So it sounds like a lot, but we're still in the lab, still counting and cataloging. We have vessels, we have personal items, we have tobacco pipes, and we have things that are interesting because they could have been used by Harriet Tubman, and as well, of course, as Ben Ross and others who may have lived there. But yeah, we have hundreds of artifacts.
We're here in the library at the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad State Park and Visitor Center, and we're sitting around a table, and in front of you is a pink shopping bag with an image of Santa Claus and a reindeer. And the reindeer has a wreath around its neck and Christmas ornaments from its antlers. And out of the top of this bag is a plastic bag. And I suspect there are some goodies in it that you would like to share.
Yeah, this was a right-sized bag for what I had to bring today.
Oh, it's perfect.
So what I have is I have a bag of small finds, is what we call them. And then below, there's the largest artifact from the site. But let me go ahead and begin to. I'm going to put my glasses on.
Oh, fantastic.
And what you'll see is these are just little bits because, again, they entered the archaeological record. These objects entered the archaeological record because they were either lost or broken, right? So we're finding broken things. And I'm going to start with what we call ceramics or, you know, sometimes people call it pottery, but usually that's for older artifacts and pre-contact items. But this is going to be
pre-contact.
That's a really crude, rudimentary pottery or ceramic that people of African descent made that was a little bit fashioned off after the native pottery.
Gotcha.
So pre-contact, we like to say it's usually native people.
Yes.
Because a lot of times we stay away from the word prehistory because that's suggesting that they didn't have history.
That's right.
So we use pre-contact. But this would be just historic period. So we're looking at, you know, for Maryland, that's the 1600s up until about 50 years ago. This isn't ceramic. This is a part of a tobacco pipe bowl. And it's wrapped in acid-free paper because we don't want to have any more damage to it. But what you're seeing here is this is a tobacco pipe bowl. And you can see inside of it, it's blackened from where it was smoked.
And is that kaolin?
Yeah, kaolin clay tobacco pipe. So it's white. and imprinted on it, you're barely going to be able to look at because you're just seeing a piece of it, but you have part of an eagle, and its talons, it's got the arrows, and then so this would have been some of a crest, like an eagle crest, and on the back there's stars. And here, you can hold that.
That's fantastic.
What I love about this is that I think about the person who smoked it, and I wonder to myself, what were they thinking? What did the eagle symbolize to them? Was it freedom? Was it some sort of, were they patriotic? Pipes themselves, when you're in a social setting and you're holding it in your hand and you're smoking it, you're communicating.
Yes.
Your thoughts,
yeah.
Your affiliations. So I wonder what this meant to the person who smoked it. And if they're of African descent, I don't know.
I seem to recall reading about a pipe stem that was found on a location here in Maryland where some DNA was recovered. Do you recall that?
Yes, that was my site too.
Oh, that was your site. Oh,
yeah,
so that's great.
This is great. That is.
I bet you do recall it.
Yes, yeah, so I'm going to tell you a story. So Belvoir is located right outside of Annapolis, and it was a quarter site. It was made of stone. It was built in the late 18th century. And was abandoned around 1864, emancipation in Maryland, right? So enslaved people lived there. And I remember thinking to myself, we need to just gather some of those clay tobacco pipe stems because I watch a lot of investigative discovery, forensic files, those sorts of shows. And I always see these forensic investigators taking old cigarettes and doing DNA and trying to link, of course, the person with the DNA. And I thought to myself, I'm going to go ahead and gather some of these up. I'm going to send them to a DNA lab and see what I can get. What if there's human DNA? And of course, a lot of times people are thinking, there's no way you're going to get anything out of that. That's like 200 years old. That's old DNA. But I did it anyway because I didn't, what do I have to lose? So I sent the pipe stems. I had four of them. And I sent them to a lab and a DNA lab, an ancient DNA lab for artifacts. And it came back. And two of the four pipe stems were positive for women's DNA. So that already kind of takes your ideal of who's smoking these pipes, and you start seeing women putting them between their teeth and their lips and smoking and pulling upon the tobacco. And then one of the four had enough DNA to make an ancestral link to West Africa. Specifically, the person who smoked this one tobacco pipe was a woman who was most genetically similar to the Mende of Sierra Leone, West Africa. Wow. So that, to me, all of a sudden we have this little place in Maryland, in Crownsville, Maryland, linked to the transatlantic slave trade, West Africa. And it was jaw-dropping, right? I was lucky, but it was also, science is now catching up to our questions, and they're able to answer that.
And how did your colleagues, writ large, react to this?
The colleagues, they love the idea of it, but the problem is that you have to have almost perfect conditions for that DNA to survive all those years, because DNA is fragile, and you start exposing it to sun and to moisture, your fluctuations of wet, dry, and it quickly disintegrates and it degrades, so you have nothing. Today we spit in tubes, right? You go to Ancestry, you spit in your tube, and all of a sudden you have all these cousins all over the world. But what happens with us in archaeology when we take artifacts like this? It's the DNA is so degraded that we're lucky if we get the sex, XX or XY for male or female. Yeah. And we're even more lucky if we can determine whether the person is of European ancestry or African ancestry. So in this case, there's databases now where you can look at the DNA and see who they're most closely related to, which makes sense because Sierra Leone, there was a lot of people that were kidnapped and brought here from there.
So what else do you have?
So there's very few, and on enslaved sites in general, and that's another reason we think that we have a place of someone who was impoverished or enslaved, or at least had very little means, is because we have other artifact assemblages in different sites to compare to. So it's not just like we're looking at these and saying, oh, this looks like it could be, a place of someone wealthy or not so well off or middle class. Is that we do have archaeologists who have been working out there for decades that have comparative assemblages. So this right here is a bone button, and it has a string through. It's a four-hole bone button. It has a string through it that has its little catalog number on it. But this is a great artifact, and I love buttons because everybody can identify with a button. We've all lost a button. We all have touched them. We know what they feel like. And this actually allows us to even feel closer to the people we are studying because, you know, it's a common artifact.
They hold the same design. There's four holes for the for the thread to go through.
Yep. The invention of the button and the buttonhole has been around for a long time, and it's served its function and it continues to do so. Mm. So this is fragile. Back then, a lot of times they made them out of bone or shell. And this particular one was probably worn on a shirt, or it could have been a pants button because people had button flies before zippers.
Mm, yes.
So, you know, you can think about this one if you really want to let your imagination go, that Ben Ross had this on his shirt while he was working in the wooded wetlands of Dorchester County, bringing down timber to be put into the Blackwater River, up Stewart's Canal, and then to the ports up to north to Baltimore.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so, again, little powerful objects.
Yes.
Okay, so we go to ceramics?
Yes.
Okay.
I see some colorful things in there.
That is, I love historic ceramics because they're beautiful, they're interestingly decorated, but it's also, when we started pulling these out of Harriet Tubman's, you know, birthplace, you know, her where the Ben Ross site is specifically, people questioned whether we had a place where enslaved people lived. They said, how could they have afforded cups and saucers and pitchers that have these intricate, beautiful designs on them? And I tell them it's that these objects were necessities. These weren't teacups, you know, fancy porcelain teacups. This was functional. If you needed to have water or milk or whatever you had a pitcher like this, and that it was taken and used. This would have been dipped. The colors are, it's a very, very pale yellow, but these can also be kind of a medium colored yellow. It's banded on top. There's a sky blue color band, and that has dark, dark brown bands on either side of it. And if we had the whole piece, you'd see this kind of worm-like pattern that would scroll around the outside of this picture.
You can see portions of that.
Yeah, you can see how they kind of, so this is very common during the first half of the 19th century. Very earthy colors.
One point in the early 90s, I worked in the historians division for our local park system in the county I'm from, and I shared an office with the county archaeologist, and on a weekly basis would go out with him to different dig sites. Mm-hmm. And one thing I discovered after a while was there were certain types of artifacts that were found at lots of different sites. And the one that always cracked me up was Rebecca at the Well.
Yes. That was a good Rebecca at the Well. Rebecca at the Well, though, that her picture was everywhere. It was in, I remember when I was digging in Nevada in the West Coast, that area, in the mining sites of the late 19th century, we'd be pulling up little bits of Rebecca at the Well. And those are great. Those are pictures. And they had a picture of the biblical Rebecca at the Well. And a lot of times they were kind of tortoiseshell colored.
Yes.
So the kind of yellow,
right.
Brown, swirly.
Brown,
yeah.
Yes.
So that was a very popular one.
Yeah. And the fascinating thing was how often shard was pulled out. And then the different books were pulled out. Mm-hmm. And they were able to identify. I was like, oh, it's this one. And so there was approximate date and often a maker, and it added a lot of color, if you will, to a site and gave you just a different perspective of what life for those people might have been like.
I mean, and that's, I think, the most important thing is that it's not just an object, it's not just a thing. There's a person behind this. There's a person behind who made it. There's a person who sold it. There's a person who bought it or it was given to. And there's a person who used it, and there's a person who broke it. So when you see these inanimate objects, they're really, there's the people behind it, and that's our job as archaeologists, is to try and understand who those people are, right? So this one's a similar design. It's a dipped ware again, and it has like this relief, this green on it. It's got the brown. And these types of dipped ware, as you can see, they're very earth tones. And sometimes they come in patterns that are reflective of African textiles.
Mm, interesting.
And I wonder if, because a lot of times people look at these and think, oh, well, the enslaver gave it to the person. And that's not always true, that they were allowed to at least make some money, or if they made an errand and enslaved people made an errand and their enslaver might give them like a reward. And so those coins would have been saved up and they could have been used to purchase a teacup or a personal item. So when you see these, there's choice behind these.
Yeah, and we know from Tubman's own history that at one point she is able to hire out her time. Mm-hmm. She brokers a deal with Edward Brodus, hire out her time, pay him a certain amount annually, and then she becomes a free agent. And of course, she's able to sock away money and so forth.
I mean, you have to be resourceful, right? And enslaved people would also keep gardens.
Yes.
They'd raise chickens, and they'd go sell those vegetables and fruit and the eggs to make that little extra change. And some people have these stories about saving so much money that way that they're able to buy the freedom of their loved ones. And, I mean, can you imagine?
Great incentive, yeah.
So there's also, we talked earlier about animals, how they were given, and we talked about them being as rations. This here, it looks a little gnarly, and it's pointed, it's jagged, and it's a tooth, and it's from a pig.
Oh, wow.
So again, that kind of the representation of pork being...
Oh, that's incredible.
You know, here, you can hold it.
Yes.
You can feel the enamel on that.
So my understanding is that a lot of bone fragments might have cut marks on it that indicate the type of tool that was used or whatnot. What were you seeing at the site?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. That's something we ask a lot of time, like, what can this tell us about the people who live there, how they process the bone, and does it show us starvation diet of some sort? So what we're seeing is that a lot of times on these sites, even at the Ross location, is that these bones, especially the ones from the feet and the heads, are a lot of times cut up very, very small. Those small pieces are used in soups and stews because, one, they can feed a lot of people, but also soups and stews can also be flavored and seasoned to reflect African cuisine. Mm. So that's one thing we have to remember, too, is that the last thing to disappear from anybody's culture, from anybody's ethnic heritage, our recipes, right? So I have Norwegian background, but my people have been over here for over 200 years, but I can't speak Norwegian. I don't know that much about the Norwegian culture, but I can tell you that during Christmas we make lefse. So that's the same thing here in the wetlands of Dorchester County, is that the last thing that's going to be disappearing from the landscape and from their kitchens are going to be the foodways. So we're seeing that in the archaeological record.
Wow. What other goodies you have here?
So one thing that archaeologists always have in their collections are mystery objects. Mm. And I want to give you a test here.
Okay.
So I want you to look at this little object and tell me and describe what you're seeing, what you think it may be.
So what I'm looking at is somewhat of a cylinder shape. It looks like it's made of metal. It's a pattern, meaning it's got a series of bands going around it, and the bands have lines or perforations. It actually looks like a metal basket. The top and bottom of it are open, so you can see through it, and there is a string drawn through it, which it just holds the holds the tag with the identifying number.
So what do you think it is?
I think it's a bead.
So that was my thought too. And it was kind of interesting how I even found this, is because I found it yesterday in the lab. I'm talking to my lab archaeologist, and I said, what is this? This looks like a bead or something. He's like, yeah, we didn't know what it was. I'm like, you guys need to tell me about these things.
Yes.
And so they're like, we just don't know what it is. And so I looked at it and I thought, could it be a bead? But the hole's very, very large. Could it be an African bead? But it also could be something completely the opposite of that. It could be something that was a little bit more utilitarian. If you think about the design, it reminds me of the little metal piece between the traditional pencil, like a wooden pencil, and then the eraser, and that little
yes.
metal piece.
Yeah.
It's not the same shape, it's not the same size, but it kind of reminds me of something like that. So I'm wondering, was it a brush on one end and then like there was a stick on like a stick on the other?
Yeah, so something more utilitarian.
Yeah.
It is interesting. Recently, I came across a runaway notice for some Africans that were here in Maryland that had been purchased at auction. And in the description of this family who arrived and within a month attempted an escape, the enslaver commented on every aspect of them, from their height, physical traits, scarification from the nation that they came from, and that they had with them beads. I can't imagine, you know, whether this is a bead or not, I can't imagine enslaved people living without forms of adornment, things that hearken to their origins, things that, you know, make them unique, and things that were mysterious and were not explained to the outside world. So whether you ever find out what it is or not, it's definitely a mystery item, right?
Well, that's the thing, is that that's what this little object is doing, is it's making us think about the people, how they adorn themselves, how they kept, how they individualize themselves. Did they put this, did they take this, even if it was utilitarian, did they take it and then have another purpose for it? Did they wear it around their neck, around their wrist? What did they put in their hair? How did they adjust their clothing to make it fit a little bit tighter or a little bit looser? So that's the thing, is this little object, even though we might not know what it is, it does kind of make us think about these people in a more personal, individual way, so that they're not just faceless people.
Yeah, and this just reminds me, I know that over the past several decades at sites that are associated with African Americans, archaeologists have been discovering crystals in door jams and other things that may harken back to African religious practices. Have you found anything along those lines?
Yes. Yes, of course we found. Sometimes I expect to find them in certain areas, and sometimes I expect to find them and I don't find them. But yeah. Harriet Tubman's birthplace, again, you're looking at 1,000 acres. We found Ben Ross's place. We've got that. Check. But then we also want to know where the rest of the enslaved people lived on this 1,000 acres. Anthony Thompson, by the time he passed, enslaved 43 people. Some of them, of course, were rented out other places and other farms, but there had to have been other people living somewhere. And so we did find a 20-foot by 30-foot, what I believe is a quarter site, that was at least lived in by enslaved people by around 1810. And the reason I say that, and the reason I can say that, is because in front of the fireplace, we found a West African spirit bundle. And that spirit bundle contained a heart-shaped glass bottle stopper, a round button. It had brick pieces, it had ceramic with some of it with blue on it, and it had nails. So when you have that collection of not necessarily what the item was, but the material it was made out of,
yes,
that's what empowers this bundle, this
wow,
this Nikisi, if you will. It's from the Bakongo. There were Christians here, but there were also people who still adhered to that West African religion. We talked about how food is one of the last things to disappear from a culture. Also, it's religion as well.
And I guess you didn't bring the spirit bundle with you today.
I didn't know we were going to be talking about the Thompson.
Oh, my gosh.
That's for another time.
I'm teasing.
Yeah.
This has been absolutely fantastic. So anything else in your...
Yeah, we talked about how do we know there was a building there, a home, and there was window glass. There were bits of hardware. There was a lock as well. But there was also a lot of brick. And although some of them, most of them, were in little bits of pieces, we did have one. And I love bringing this out to public events because everybody can touch it. They can feel it. And it's huge, it's massive, and it's heavy.
Wow. And where... where exactly, of course, not exactly, but where on the Thompson acreage was this discovered?
This is coming from Ben Ross's house location. So somewhere, again, I couldn't pinpoint where his house was exactly, what corners, but some of this brick was loose, and this was a looser brick that was around the place where his home once stood. So this was incorporated in some way, whether it was part of a brick pier or whether it was for something else. We don't know because it was not in situ or in place of where it was originally placed. But it's associated with the site, and it's interesting. It's huge. It's handmade. It's old.
What are the dimensions of it? Do you know?
Oh, I don't know. It's huge, but you can see where... See how it's kind of glazed on this side?
Yes.
A lot of times when you see, if you look up in historic colonial homes and a brick house, you'll see 1797 or 1760 something in brick. Well, they're using the glazed part of that brick to make that outline. So these will be put in a kiln, it'll be fired, and it's just the way that it came out.
Wow. Yeah.
And the bricks get reused all the time.
Right.
In fact, in the Thompson Quarter site where we found that West African spirit bundle, that was a 20-foot by 30-foot foundation, and it was brick, but once it was abandoned, they went back and took out all the brick from where the fireplace was and where the foundation was, and anything that broke, they threw back in the builder's trench.
Mm.
And so we ended up seeing that. That's how the brick was used, but it was recycled, and it was used all over the place. So probably another building somewhere out there.
Absolutely. So you talked about the archaeological process, bit about sources which kind of led you to the site. Where does interpretation come in? So you do all this work, you have this stuff, it could forever live in a laboratory, right? But there's the public, right? How do you connect the two, your work with the public and educating about what you've discovered?
As a state agency, I'm the public's archaeologist. So anything that we do is done with taxpayer money, which means that there has to be a robust interpretive product that comes out of it, many interpretive products in this case. So we're doing everything where what we've discovered will come out in interpretive panels. When we partner with Dorchester County, we can work with them if they want updated materials. These artifacts can and should go into different displays and exhibits across the state, also across the nation. Because one of the questions we get is, what happened to the artifacts? And once we're done analyzing them, they will go down to our state repository in Maryland, in Calvert County. And from there, they can be loaned out to different institutions and for different exhibits. The artifacts go on display. The material and information will come out in reports. I also plan to write a book on the archaeology of Harriet Tubman's birthplace. So this will be, and those books are publicly accessible, meaning you don't have to be a PhD holding archaeologist to be able to digest what I'm going to be writing and talking about. This is going to make sense to everybody.
When does it come out?
Oh, I haven't even started. I have to get done with all that. That's the thing, is that archaeology is such a long, laborious process. Every week you spend in the field, you're spending months in the lab and doing research and historical research and analysis. So we're done with the Ben Ross site for now. We could go back, but at this point, it's all about funding as well. So we're going to stop for now, and we're going to finish up the rest of the Harriet Tubman birthplace in the Thompson Quarter, which is where we found the spirit bundle. We'll finish that up probably next year or two, and then after that, we'll start looking at rolling out a book.
You had mentioned that there were a variety of different people on site, including people from the descendant community. What was that like working with, non-archaeologists, but people who have a connection, a communal stake in the story?
Yeah, we took both, of course, Tina Wyatt and Douglas Mitchell. They're well known in the Tubman circles, but we also took a lot of local descendants down as well and gave them tours, because not everybody went north. A lot of people stayed, and they stayed here because they loved their families and this was their home. And so those descendant communities are still here. They're still in Dorchester County. This is their heritage. And so we took the time to take them down there and show them what we're doing archaeologically, what we're finding, and why it's important. So they had questions. They wanted to hold things. And just, it gave them a chance to really be reverent and in the moment, and it allowed them to time travel. Mm-hmm. And so that was the least we could do. We're also now, from the archaeology, going into an oral history project with the Malone's Church community. So we're learning all about not just Harriet Tubman now, but we're learning about Harriet Tubman's neighbors and her more distant family and the people that stayed.
Could you just describe Malone's and how the proximity to this site, Ben's Ten site and Thompson Plantation?
Malone's church is located on White Marsh Road, just south of Madison. If you drive down there, you'll see it on your left. It's on the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad byway, and you can stop there and you'll see a church. The church you're seeing in front of you is more late 19th century, but there was a building there by 1864. There was also a schoolhouse. Well, they had the schoolhouse standing up until more recently, but it had to come down because it was a ruin. But we always wondered, where is the 1864 church? What happened to that? Was that part of the school? We didn't know. And then they received some money to restore it and to put a new roof on it. And when they were ripping off the siding, I looked in the middle of that church and I saw this hand-hewn timbers and cut nails, which are from usually the 19th century. And I wondered to myself, is the original church in the middle of this standing building? So when people go to visit that and they look at Malone's church, they're looking at an older church than the late 19th century. Behind it, there's a cemetery of the ancestors, and way, way in back, there are headstones from Tubmans. I don't know how they're related to Harriet Tubman, perhaps through John Tubman, her first husband, but that's where their ancestors are, that's where their community was, and the people that lived in both Harrisville as well as the Madison area are buried there. When you think about where enslaved people lived, where the Harriet Tubman birthplace is located, and you think 1,000 acres, it kind of gets lost in our mind. We question, how did she move around? What did she see? Who did she talk to? What did it look like? Well, I can tell you that the area itself, it's forested, some of it, and it's now inundated from sea level rise. There's also a lot of fields everywhere, and within those fields there are buried homes that are no longer standing. There was Harrisville Road, and there's also White Marsh Road, which is just south of Madison, and that entire area, this large landscape, is cultural. It is where she moved around, it's where she worked, it's where Harriet Tubman was born, and it's where she was married. So when you think of Harriet Tubman, she wasn't place bound. Mm. She was all over the place.
Yeah, she was.
And she knew people and she saw things. And she took those memories and that culture with her when she went north. And when she was in Auburn and New York, I think some of her stories, her memories, her practices, and oral histories there probably remember that Dorchester County culture.
Yes.
It's traveled all the way to New York because that's what ideas and people and culture do.
Absolutely. Kind of makes me think of information that I learned as a child in the 70s. I think I was probably about 10 years old in 1973 when I first learned about Harriet Tubman, and actually through a comic book. But one of my kind of long-term factoids I always remembered was that she was from Bucktown.
Mm-hmm.
But now we know through careful scholarship that's not where she was born. It was one of the places that she eventually grew up, but that Thompson Plantation was where she was born. What kinds of new interpretations, new discoveries, corrections in the historical record stand out for you having worked on this project?
The work on the archaeology side, of course, the analysis is still ongoing and results are pending. But I think just as someone coming into the area with a fresh set of eyes and just looking at Harriet Tubman, I realized that her success depended on everyone else around her. So I think what it allowed me to do is it allowed me to realize that Harriet Tubman, of course, she was a shero. She was wonderful. She did things that no one else could have or would have done. But she also had help, and she had a family, and she had a father, and she had a mother, and she had friends and neighbors, and all those people helped her and supported her and helped her do what she did. The archaeology gives us a more holistic view of her life, and I think that it encourages us to look beyond the plantation, and it causes us to look at roadways and rivers and how all this infrastructure and these waterways and just the natural environment both helped and hurt her. as she moved people north. So I think it just gives us a very, it opens everything up. Yes. It's about landscape, and it's about movement of people and ideas.
So you've done all this research, all this exploration of this site, which I understand is at risk.
The risk is sea level rise, and it's climate change. I will tell you, in the last 5 years I've been down to that site, each time I go down there to dig, it gets worse and worse and worse, which was shocking because when I heard it was threatened and I saw that the waters were rising, I didn't think it would happen so quickly. So can an archaeologist go back there and dig it next year and the year after? Perhaps, with difficulty, with pumps. But it's probably going to be gone within the next several years. I don't think you're going to be able to successfully, one, access it physically. But then when you go to dig it, it'll just, your holes will just fill right up. Unless we have some sort of drought, it's going to be remaining inaccessible.
So the site will eventually vanish. What you've recovered will be preserved. But what will be lost? What will be gone that can never be replaced?
Well, we dug enough that I think we have, we can say that it was Ben Ross's place. And that space and time is important to have nailed down, which we've done. What's going to be gone is a few things. The physical location, of course, but also the potential for the public, for descendants to access that site. So we've looked at, can you bring people down there? And the answer is no. And we thought about, can you maybe build a raised walkway down there? But what's the point if it's going to be completely vanished within the next decade? So what we've lost is a physical location and for people to go there, to feel it, to be in that moment and to be in that space and time travel.
Thank you. This has been illuminating, and it's really nice to know that long after we're gone, these fragments of the Tubman and Ross family story will live on.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you about this.
Rooted Wisdom is a production of Beachworks in collaboration with the Monair Foundation. This episode was produced and recorded by Lauren Giordano and George Burrows. Special thanks to our guests, Julie Shablitsky and the Maryland Department of Transportation. We'd also like to thank Kate Clifford Larson, Dana Patera, and the staff of the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad State Park and Visitor Center, and Ray Patera and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Ben Ross's home site is located on Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge. Managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge protects over 33,000 acres of tidal marsh, forest, and manage freshwater wetlands and croplands for a diversity of wildlife. The refuge provides important habitat for migratory waterfowl and other species, like the once-endangered Delmarva Peninsula fox squirrel and bald eagle. The impacts of climate change are clearly evident at the refuge. Over 5,000 acres of marsh have already been lost to open water as a result of sea level rise, subsidence, and the effects of invasive species like nutria. The Ben Ross home site, located on lands acquired by the USFWS in 2020, is predicted to naturally transition from forest to marsh by the year 2100. As a result of sea level rise and subsidence. Protecting these lands for wildlife also helps protect the history of the past. The refuge is honored to be able to play a part in preserving our local and national history. I'm Tony Cohen, your host. You can find me at monair.org and buttonfarm.org. To learn more about Rooted Wisdom, visit rootedwisdom.org. Check out our available community programs, including film screenings and educational presentations. You can also email us at rootedwisdom@beachworks.org. That's B-E-E-C-H. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend about it or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or on our website.